And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Hello, Bonnie.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Well, Floridians routinely ask, where are you from? We might hail from Rhode Island or Jamaica, Cuba, South America, New York, Missouri, or Tennessee. But many, of course, were raised in the Sunshine State and have childhood memories of simpler times. As author and editor William McKean says, quote, Florida is not just a place people go to, it's where they come from. And William McKean joins us from Boston. Hello, Bill. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Also with us is Palm Beach Post columnist and author Carlos Frias. His essay about treasured grandparents is in the book as well. Welcome, Carlos.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Carlos, my Kentucky Fried Cuban. Want to explain that?
Yeah, I worked for a long time at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and really traveled the South quite a bit, just getting to know people's stories, you know, personal stories, and telling them in the newspaper and such. And I just felt like Southern Fried Cuban was an apt description, but I do feel like that. I do feel really connected to the South and really connected to my Cuban roots, even though I'm born in South Florida.
Of course, Carlos is an occasional contributor to Topical Currents, and we appreciate your work very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And William, what began this venture, and what criteria did you use to compile your anthology? How'd you make your choices?
Well, it's kind of weird. This all started about 2005 and was interrupted by two other books I did. So I've been carrying this book around for a while. But the writer Tim Dorsey, who writes all these manic novels of craziness in Florida, came to visit me when I taught at the University of Florida to speak to class. And we started trading stories about how Florida used to be when we were growing up in the 60s. And then the very next day, I get in the mail a DVD from another friend, Jeff Klinkenberg, who writes for the Tampa Bay Times. And he had put together the story of his life in a movie using the old Super 8 movies of his mother, who had recently died. So he'd been going through her things. And I saw the parrot jungle, and I saw the monkey jungle, and I saw the sequarium, and I saw the old 7 Mile Bridge. And I saw that childhood I grew up in the 60s, and my dad lived on Homestead Air Force Base. And so I thought, there's something here. There's something special about childhood in Florida. And so I kind of put out word to people I knew that I was thinking of doing a collection on this. And I had written one story already about an incident in my childhood in Florida. And then I wrote another one just for the book that was about being on Homestead Air Force Base as a kid during the Cuban Missile Crisis, because, of course, the end of the world may have been looming, but the most important thing about that was that it screwed up Halloween that year.
Right.
So, you know, I put out word about these stories, and then people started sending them to me. And then I would meet people, and you know, they would come up in conversation. Before long, I had a bunch of stories, and like I said, two other books intervened, and I finally got the book done about a year ago and put it out, and I couldn't be happier with it. I think it's a nice broad range of stories.
Bill McKeon, you talked about Super 8. I haven't thought about Super 8 in many, many, many years. It reminds me of people calling person-to-person long distance.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think
this is? This is about those, you know, a lot of it's about the old days, you know. I told Tim Dorsey at the time that, you know, we could get together a collection of stories, but it couldn't just be a couple of aging Pillsbury doughboys such as ourselves. It would really have to reflect the diversity of Florida, because, of course, that's Florida's strength, is that it's a melting pot that hasn't quite melted. And there's so many different people from different backgrounds, and I wanted the book to reflect that. I wanted them to be stories from the Panhandle. I wanted them stories from you know, rural Central Florida. I wanted stories from Miami. And I'm pretty happy with the cultural mix in
the
book.
Well, Carlos Frias is a little bit younger than you and I and Bonnie, Bill McKean. Well, I won't speak for Bonnie. But
thank you.
Anyway, tell us, Carlos, about you growing up in Northwest Dade. I think your family was in the jewelry business, and you were born in this country, but, of course, had really strong Cuban ties. And you wrote about your abuelitos.
Right. I mean, for me, I tried to find. Bill was nice enough to ask me to contribute to the book, and I tried to find something that was really seminal for me as a person, like something that really affected me in my growing up. And for me, it was these next door neighbors of my parents who watched me while they worked all day, you know, 12, 14 hour days, and they were older and came abuelitos, you know, my grandparents, and. You know, and so I told the story about my time with them and how, you know, how they affected me and how not having them around affected me. And I think, frankly, it's a very personal story, but I think that's the beauty of Homegrown, is that it's a collection of many personal stories spanning, you know, different generations, because I'm in my 30s, and I think you get a real wide variety of what it means to grow up in Florida over the last, you know, over the last 50 years, really. There's a wonderful story from Miami Herald columnist Fabiola Santiago about having her teen sis, about turning 15.
Right.
There's an incredible story called Night Shift from the novelist Michael Connelly. They're filled with that. I mean, and Bill's story... about his brother, you know, why Chuck wouldn't get out of the car is a struggle with, you know, what does life mean? You know, what's it all about? And you have all these very personal stories that really paint a broad picture of what Florida is and what it was.
You know, talking about that, why Chuck wouldn't get out of the car, Bill, it was so vivid and universal in its themes. Basically, I'll just explain it. It was your Nietzsche and Spinoza reading brother, several years your senior, usually really cool and calm, and now you discover him sitting in the car afraid because he's going off to college and he's crying he doesn't want to go off to college. I was wondering if that incident changed your relationship with your brother.
You know, it's kind of funny because I wrote that story kind of as a challenge in one of my classes at University of Florida. I would teach the beginning writing class, and there were 400 students in there, and I said, I want to show you all that you're all really good writers when you care about the subject. So you write me a story about the most important moment in your life. And to show you what I'm talking about, I'll write one. So I wrote that story and read it aloud to my class, and then they all wrote their stories, and they were fabulous. And it was a confidence building exercise. But about 3 or 4 years later, I finally showed it to my brother, or I mailed it to him, I guess. He took it home, and he read it to his 5 children, and cried. And they couldn't believe that their dad was ever, you know, filled with any sort of doubt or you know, teenage remorse or angst, because you know he's become this. You know, phenomenally successful and confident surgeon, but
He did go on to be a doctor. I was going to ask you that.
Oh yeah, and he's in fact, he followed my father into practice. My father died, but he followed him into practice in the same town. So there's a real happy ending to that story. And when I did the one about the Cuban Missile Crisis, I knew what I wanted to say, but I wanted to prod his memory and my mother. My mother's 90. And she remembered very clearly just these incredible details about what cocktails they had that night when the flyboys came into the officers' club and they knew something was up and we woke up and there was a tank in our front yard. I mean, it was nice to go back and do that. And what's funny is I ended up with so many stories in the book that are real heartbreaking that I consider the story on the Cuban Missile Crisis to be the comic relief.
Right. You know, you... say you were afraid of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but you add that you spent a great deal of your childhood being frightened, much of it self-inflicted. Why was that?
Oh, I was just part of that Twilight Zone, Outer Limits era where you're in love with being scared. And, you know, like I have a lot of kids, and now when they're scared, they come and crawl in bed with me. I wasn't so obnoxious about it. I'd go crawl into my parents' bathroom and sleep on the floor, but I just need to be close to them. You know, I would... But I, you know, the Twilight Zone used to scare the stuffing out of me.
Now,
of course, I laugh at it.
Yeah. You spoke about having some very serious stories, and I guess none would be more serious than Jeff Klinkenberg's story of a kid fishing for snook at the Miami Shores golf course. Tell us about that, Bill.
You know, it's kind of funny. I've got that story in the book, but I think I've only read it 4 times because it's so heartbreaking. I can't go back to it. I can't even think about it without, you know, reliving it about this. Jeff was with one of his best friends at the moment of his death. And, you know, I had known Jeff 20 years before I saw that story. And to know he was carrying that around with him, I mean, it was it belittles it, I guess, to say it was a life-changing moment for Jeff. But it's such a good story. I put it in there. In fact, the original title of this book was going to be Paradise Recalled, because we thought, well, we're going to get all these happy memories. And then we find out, you know, here's these stories of bigotry and racism and the poor kid dying and this and that. And in fact, there's one story that was just so tragic. The editor told me to take it out, and I think it was the right decision. I sought a story from Mark Lunsford. I wanted him to write about the lost childhood of his daughter, Jessica, who had been abducted and killed some years ago in North Central Florida. And it was a very powerful piece of writing. It was too much for this book, and I hope he does something with that story. But I just thought, I can't lay that on people. That's the every parent's nightmare. So, hey, the book could have had a little bit more tragedy to it, but I did take that out.
We're speaking with author and editor William McKean. He's written Homegrown, or edited Homegrown in Florida. It's a compilation, an anthology of a lot of memoirs. We're also speaking with Carlos Frias. He is an author and Palm Beach Post columnist. Stay with us. We need to take a short break on today's Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
And we do return. It's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And we're joined by William McKean and also Carlos Frias. Carlos, you mentioned the Miami Herald writer Fabiola Santiago, also a novelist, of course. I was interested that she talked about her quinceanera, which you mentioned, but also the chaperones, and that leaving the Cuban oppression behind her sort of old-world Cuban parents, she always had to wear a one-piece bathing suit. That bugged her.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of these stories, that you find there's little there's photographs of culture as it was, you know, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, in my case, you know, 20 years ago, you know, because we are all looking back, and when we do that, we are reaching back and grabbing this one frozen in time moment, and in that it's like looking at an old photograph. Like, I can't believe the pants that I was wearing. I can't believe the glasses I was wearing. And I think the book lets you do that. It lets folks of all generations read these stories and recall that time. I think that's why the stories are so moving, is because we can really identify with them. You don't have to be a Floridian, but it does help.
Carlos is also the author of a tremendous book called Take Me With You, which recounts his visit to Cuba, where he had never been before. He was born and raised in the U.S., but he went back and visited family members there.
I was going to ask each of you, and either one of you can respond first, in our ultra-mobile digital culture, do you think the sense of place has been diluted by globalization, technology, social networking? Do you think that an up-and-coming generation could write memoirs or essays such as these?
Carlos, you go first.
Oh, boy, thanks. I did hear someone recently say that Twitter is the lost opportunity for a poem. So there is the sense that you know, we let little pieces of us out to the world so much more carelessly. But then again, you know, we all lay our heads to sleep on our beds at night. You know, we don't sleep in the global community. We you know, children wake up to their parents, and you know, every single family has their own rhythm. So I think that, you know, even though our lives are more exposed, they are still as personal as they've ever been. And frankly, I've read some memoirs recently and certainly some fiction that I would say that, you know, our abilities to tell stories are, you know, stronger than ever, actually.
Hmm. And William, what do you think?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts, and one is that we're missing so much of the world around us. And, you know, for years I taught at the University of Florida, which has a beautiful campus, And I'd walk across campus, treat myself to a walk, and realize that nobody was looking at the beauty. They were all looking at some device held about 5 inches from their face.
Right.
And now I live and work in Boston, which is a gorgeous walking city. I mean, I just walk down the street and I'm stunned by the beauty. And it's the same thing. People are walking around with their noses stuck in this. And so I kind of think that we're missing an awful lot. And I think the nature of childhood has changed so much. Because I was thinking about this when I was writing my story about the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, I'd get up in the morning and I'd have breakfast with the folks. And then I'd hop on my bike and I might not come home till 8 o'clock at night. And my mother and father never worried. Now, granted, I was living on a, you know, United States Air Force base, but we had so much freedom. Every night, or at least every other night, I used to go to the movie theater on base and pay my 15 cents and see a different film. And today we have to be so hyper-vigilant about our children that I'm afraid they're getting suffocated and they're having all these interior childhoods instead of these wonderful exterior childhoods we used to have. So that's the big difference I noted when I was thinking about the childhoods we portray in this book. There's one of my favorite pieces is by an author who died years ago named Rob White, and it's from a Florida childhood classic called The Lion's Paw. And it's the sort of childhood that I remember as a kid. We read that book. That's what we all wanted to have. We wanted that kind of life. And, you know, now every kid's inside playing Minecraft or, you know, with some gaming device or stealing dad's iPad, whatever.
Right.
How about a website where people can learn more about you and the book, Bill?
Oh, I have a website called William McKean, just my name, William, McKeen, as a noodle, .com. And I post, they want to get a sample of the book, I posted my two stories on the page for the book. And I've got a lot of other articles and stories there. And I do want to put in another endorsement for Carlos's great book, Take Me With You. I think that's one of the best books I've read in the last 10 years.
How about a website?
Of course, why I asked him to write for this book.
How about a website for you, Carlos?
It's just simply cfrias.com. That's CFRIAS.com.
William, I have a paragraph here from the arsenal, from the Cuban Missile Crisis story. And just to give people a feel of 1962 when you were at Homestead Air Force Base, I just want to read this one paragraph about the movies. Movies cost me 15 cents, adults paid 35, and we got our money's worth. In addition to the feature, we had newsreels, cartoons, and a raft of previews. Then just before the picture began, everyone in the theater stood for the playing of the Star Spangled Banner as a huge black and white flag rippled on the dirty gray screen. I was a kid, but I felt that we were all in the military service, not just our fathers. I didn't see my first civilian feature until I was 17 and on a date. What the hell, I said, when the Warner Brothers logo burst onto the screen after a few sets of previews. When do we stand for the anthem? My girlfriend rolled her eyes at me like I was insane. It was the first of many shocks from the outside world. So what were some other shocks? And that was great.
I remember so many things about growing up in the military in Homestead Air Force Base, and one was that no matter where you were, at 5 o'clock you pulled off the side of the road and you stood at attention, and they played Taps. It was a strange culture. I felt I grew up free of a lot of, although I spent most of my life in the South, I don't think I saw the racial prejudice that other people in the South saw, because that didn't exist in the military, at least not in my era. So, you know, when I went to my first civilian school from middle school, all my buddies from, we were in the South, all my buddies from sixth grade had to go to the all-black school, and I was going to an all-white school, and it was a shock and a rude awakening. And so I've always spoken fondly of my military upbringing, because I think it did a lot to shape my character.
Carlos Frias, I understand you have the book with you. How about reading a couple of paragraphs from your essay?
Sure, of your
choice.
Sure. Just to give a kind of a summary, it's you know, it's when I was about 12 years old. The book is my section is entitled 12, and it's when I was 12 years old, and these two elderly folks who I called my grandparents, my abuelitos, when it came as a surprise one day when their natural family, their natural born family, came to take them to Wisconsin where they lived. So it kind of, you know, they had kept it from me. It's, you know, they didn't want to, you know, get me feeling nervous and upset before the actual day. So it all kind of just happened one day as a surprise. And in this section where I'm going to read, I'm missing them for the first time. I miss the quiet. I miss sitting on the porch with both of them and watching the rainfall. Squalls swirling in the night, sending rivulets down to the street and the slow-moving cars. I miss counting Volkswagen Beetles with Abuelito. I miss the telenovelas. I miss watching Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom while dunking buttery Cuban crackers in the watered-down Cuban espresso Abuelita made for me, because I was too young, and for Abuelito, because his stomach was fragile. I miss curling up next to Abuelita, squeezing into her recliner, and burying my head into the crook of her neck while she pats my back, rhythmically, as if timed by a metronome. I miss it, and I want it back. I want it all back.
It's really touching.
Yeah, it is. William, although you live in Boston, do you still feel like your roots are here in Florida?
Yeah, I can't get away from the place. I seem to come there about four times a year for one thing or another, and still own property there, although I'm trying to sell it. I think, you know, I've spent most of my life there. I lived there as a child. I came back as an adult, as a reporter, and then I came back as a professor in state for 24 years. And, you know, my children were born there, raised there, so it's always going to feel like home to me.
So what are each of you working on now? Carlos, what are you working on?
Well, I'm still busy with my 9-to-5. Like I said, like you said, I'm a writer for the Palm Beach Post, and I write long takeout features and such. And I'm now working on a series of stories on homelessness in South Florida, writing time for the holidays. And other than that, always keeping one eye on screenwriting projects and book projects like Homegrown, which helped me tap into something a little deeper within myself rather than outside myself.
And Bill?
I've been asked by the family of a deceased author to write a screenplay of one of his children's books. So this is a real change for me because, A, I've never written a screenplay, and, B, I've never written anything my kids can read. So they're excited about it because it's a book they like a lot. And I don't know if anything will come of it because I'm untested as a screenwriter, but I thought it was time to try something different.
Well, we've been speaking with author and editor William McKean and also with Palm Beach Post columnist and author Carlos Frias. We've been talking about the book Homegrown in Florida. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Food and Dining is next.
Back to Topical Currents in just a moment here on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We're also online at WLRN.org. You can discover inspiration, peace, a new perspective, community, and your divine potential at Unity on the Bay Sunday Celebration Services at 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. There's more information at UnityOnTheBay.org. Orchestra Miami presents Tough Turkey in the Big City, a free concert for kids, Friday, November 16th at 7 p.m. at the Miami Shores Presbyterian Church, and Saturday, November 17th, 1:30 p.m. at the North Dade Library. Details at orchestramiami.org. We're funded by listeners like you and by SunTrust, committed to helping clients find the financial options to help them move forward. More at livesolid.com.
There's a new theater in Key West Fringe. The Fringe takes theater out of the theater and performs in historic venues. They take Shakespeare into the schools and commission new works. From November 9th to December 2nd, they present Boston Marriage by David Mamet. It's a clever Victorian scam about two Bostonian lady friends who might be a bit more than just friends. Details at KeyWestFringe.org. Funded in part by Monroe County Tourist Development Council.
And we return this Thursday edition of Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. It's hard to believe that Thanksgiving, Linda, is just a week away. I'm joined by chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer, along with a celebrity chef. How could this holiday have sneaked up on us so quickly, Linda?
It was just what I was going to say to you. Can it be next week that it's here? Well, a yearly question we always get, how to roast the perfect turkey. Or another one I had the other day, somebody called me and said, what can I make now and freeze? So our guest is here to help us. She's Joanne Weir.
Just so you don't stuff the turkey early, right?
Well, that's another problem.
You can't do that.
Yes. Joanne Weir is a television personality. Her latest book is Cooking Confidence, Dinner Made Simple, and it's a companion to her PBS series. She's here to give us some Thanksgiving Day tips. Let's welcome Joanne Weir. Hello, Joanne.
Hi, how are you?
Great to have you with us.
Thanks.
Hello. Hello.
And Bonnie Berman just said hello to you as well.
Hi, how are you both?
And we'd also love to have you, our listeners, join us. Do you have any cooking questions, or maybe you need Thanksgiving help? Joanne Weir is here to answer them. Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
And email, that's radio@WLRN.org.
And we have another person joining us. That's our favorite wine guy. It's Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Are we drinking today, Fred?
Absolutely, and I don't think that Thanksgiving's coming too fast. I've been waiting for it for months.
For a whole year you've been waiting, right?
Absolutely. It's my favorite holiday, and I'm going to talk about some Thanksgiving wines.
Maybe there's not too much to do in Michigan, that's why.
I just think he's waiting.
Well, everybody up here is out deer hunting right now. This is the deer hunting.
Oh, don't tell us that, Fred.
All right, never mind. Congratulations to Joanne Weir for your 17th book.
I know. Is that crazy or what?
It's good. Good. Keep working. I'm glad. I've known you for a long time. You've been working on a book ever since I've known you.
I know. It's true. I'm really excited about this one, though. I really am. It's been really fun talking about it and bringing it out and sharing it with everyone. So it's great.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Thanksgiving. First of all, many people tell me they're afraid to make their own turkey. It might be dry, it might be undercooked, not ready in time. In fact, so many of them buy a cooked one. Give us some tips here so they can have a nice, freshly made turkey.
Okay. You know, I have to say, I'm always, when it gets to Thanksgiving, I'm always saying the same thing. Are you a briner or not a briner? So do you brine or not? And I do brine my turkey. So I usually buy a turkey that's around 14 pounds, and I buy it several days in advance. And when I say that, I mean 4 days. And so on 4 days before, I get the turkey. 3 days before, I brine the turkey, and I brine it for 2 days.
What do you put in the brine?
I'm just a salt and water. That's it. For each 1 cup of water, I use 1 tablespoon of kosher salt. And I know that's going to sound like it's going to be salty, but it's not. And I brine it for 2 full days.
Now, how do you take a 14-pound turkey and brine it? You put it in a plastic bag? I mean, how do you do this?
I know, that's a great question. Either a really big stock pot, or they have those brining bags now, and those work really well. And then some people even use a cooler. Of course, you're going to clean out your cooler really, really well and put the turkey in there with some ice cubes and water and the salt. And that really works, too.
Okay, well, you have to remember here in Florida to keep that cooler cool.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think the refrigerator is the best. I mean, for me, I have a big stock pot, so I put it in the refrigerator. And that's the thing. It does take a lot of room in the refrigerator, and you've got all the other things, but, you know, for Thanksgiving, but that's usually what I do. And then after those 2 days, I take it out, I pat it dry with paper towels, and then I put it on a cooling rack, set on a baking sheet, and I put that in the refrigerator overnight. So the next day, Thanksgiving Day, it's been overnight with no cover on it or anything. No,
it doesn't, and it doesn't dry out.
No, you want the skin to dry out a little bit.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. And that's how it's going to crisp.
So you don't oil the skin or anything then?
I don't. Okay, so here's what I do. So overnight in the refrigerator, take it out, get it to room temperature, and then what I do is I melt a cube of butter. I put some cheesecloth in the butter so it's completely drenched in the butter. I know this sounds like a long process. And then I tint the whole bird completely. And that's how I roast it. And I don't even have to baste it. And I'm telling you, when I take that bird out of the oven, it is moist and juicy. And it's the skin is golden and crispy. It's an amazing turkey. And my chef friends for years have said, oh, that's the best turkey I've ever had.
Well, Fred and I both approve of the butter involved.
You like the butter?
Absolutely. It's one cube,
get a little sausage in there, it'd be even better.
It's one cube. Come on.
The sausage will be in the stuffing, Fred.
Right. And here's the other problem people have. They've got a frozen bird. So,
right.
And they decided the day before that they had to do something with it. So what should they do the day before?
Well, they're going to have a really hard time. But, I mean, you've got to defrost it. See, that's why I plan way ahead. And I think for the holidays, you have to do that. I mean, it's really better to get your turkey well in advance. I mean, and then when I say that, I mean a few days so that you have it, especially if it's frozen, because you want to defrost it. And I would rather than defrosting it on your counter, you're going to want to defrost that in your refrigerator for a few days. So, you know, it takes a long time.
Putting the butter on the turkey and the cloth and everything, how do you get it to brown?
Well, actually what I do is I melt the butter in a saucepan, and then I take that cheesecloth and I put it into the saucepan so it just drenches the cheesecloth with butter. And then I drape that over the turkey.
And that browns it.
Do you take it off at any point so it'll brown, or does it brown that way?
No, it browns that way. It is gorgeous. It is the most beautiful golden brown crispy skin. It's perfection every single time.
A friend of mine is a firefighter, and he says, please do not try and do a fried turkey unless you really have your act together, because he's had calls out on Thanksgiving Day with people messing around with frying
turkeys. Burn off half your house.
Yeah.
I've heard that, too. You know, the other one that people try is they take the paper bag and they douse it with oil. I'm sure you've heard this one, and they put the turkey in it and put it in the oven. Well, of course, your oven is going to smoke. I mean, this technique I've been doing for years really works. I mean, my mother, who's a professional chef, too, retired now, but my mother even does my technique for turkey.
All right. Well, here's the other question that I have. Gravy. Now, it's really annoying to have to, you cook your turkey, you take it out, you make the gravy from the pan, juices and all, while all your friends are standing around having a good time, waiting for that turkey to carve and waiting for you to make the gravy. Can we make a gravy before we cook the turkey? What can we do?
Well, you know, okay, so here's my gravy tips.
Okay.
And this is what I do. I make, and I know this is work, but you can do it well in advance. I make chicken stock. And with the chicken stock, I make a fairly flavorful chicken stock. And by that, I mean I use 5 pounds of bones and onions and carrots. And
5 pounds of bones, wow.
Yeah, so I'm making a lot, but okay. You don't have to use all of that.
All right.
Then what I do is I strain that, and I only bring the level of the water up to the top of the bones. So don't, like, fill your stock pot and, you know, just, I want it to be flavorful. Then I strain that, and then I make another stock with new bones and that chicken stock.
Ooh.
So I'm making a double chicken stock. And honestly, Linda, when I make this, I just pour off all the fat from the pan, the pan that I've roasted the turkey in, and then I start with that double chicken stock. Or if you can make double turkey stock, that's great too. But honestly, you get tons of gravy, and it's delicious. And then I thicken it at the end with I always use not just flour, I use flour and cornstarch together. And so it's got a nice sheen, but it also has that, gravy has.
Let me understand. So your gravy is only made up of really, really, really good chicken stock that you've made well in advance. You could make it now
double,
and freeze it.
Yes, double chicken stock.
And the pan juices, and that's it?
Yes. It's so delicious. And
now,
I have
where do you get the bones to do this with?
I just buy chicken bones, like at the grocery store.
Chicken
bones.
And
they're only $1 a pound. I use backs, necks, and breast bones, whatever I can find from the butcher.
Do you leave the skin on?
Yes, you can, because you're going to, once you make your stock, you're going to, you know, skim off. I let it cool in the refrigerator, and I've got the fat that comes to the top, and I just take off all the fat, so it's completely fat-free.
Okay, so now, freezing other things. People ask me, can you freeze the stuffing? Can you freeze some of the side dishes? What can we do here? Get it ready in advance.
Before Thanksgiving or after?
Before, because now you could maybe spend some time this weekend if you're having a lot of people over and you don't want to cook last minute.
I know. See, I tend to be one of those people. I'm a more of a, you know, I'd rather cook the day before or even 2 days before, but I don't usually freeze the things before. Do you? I mean, I'm...
Well, now you've asked me, now I have to be honest with you. Yes.
What do you freeze? Which one?
Well, I'm from New England, so I make a bread stuffing. And
I love bread stuffing. You know, I grew up in New England, too, so bread stuffing's my favorite.
It has to be bread stuffing, but I make it ahead of time, and I freeze it in a nice casserole dish. I take it out, defrost it the night before in the fridge, and then I just put it in the oven.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's...
It's bread. It freezes, you know.
Yeah, I think anything we need to do to continue to cook is great. And, you know, if people do that, I think that's fine. Vegetables might be a little trickier.
Well, vegetables would be difficult, and I would make those fresh. But sometimes I take like a spaghetti squash, and I'll make a nice casserole with a spaghetti squash, and I'll freeze that. That freezes beautifully.
Or even if you do a butternut squash puree, that, I mean, you could also freeze that. That would be absolutely fine.
Right.
Okay, can I tell you my mashed potato trick that is so delicious?
And then we'll go to a break. So tell us your mashed potato trick.
Okay, I'll do it quick. So mashed potatoes, at the end, you know, you add your butter, your milk or cream or whatever. The best thing in the world, a couple of tablespoons of white wine vinegar. It makes them so zippy and delicious. And my guests are always saying, what is the trick to your potatoes? They're the best I've ever had.
Hmm. White wine vinegar. How interesting. Great. Okay, that goes along with the cream and the butter and everything else.
Right.
Yep. We can't forget that. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest today is television personality, cooking teacher, and she's also an executive chef, Joanne Weir. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more.
And this is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We'd like to thank our corporate underwriters, the Florida National University, Chapman Partnership, and Manchester Business School. These corporate underwriters help bring you the programs you enjoy throughout the year. Please join WLRN in thanking them for their continued support.
Gable Stage at the Biltmore begins their 15th anniversary season with the Southeastern premiere of Venus in Fur by David Ives, now through December 9th. A Broadway smash, this sexually charged dark comedy centers on a young actress determined to land the lead in a new play based on a classic erotic novel about a 19th century dominatrix. The New York Times called this Tony-nominated best play seriously smart and very funny. Tickets at 305-445-1119 or gablestage.org. South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center presents Siempre Flamenco's Café Cantante, a traditional flamenco performance showcasing the deep emotions that emanate from flamenco song, united with the intricate fury of dance. Evening performances November 16th and 17th, and a special matinee performance November 18th, part of the Cabaret series. Information at smdcac.org or 786-573-5300.
The Rhythm Foundation and Little Haiti Cultural Center host Big Night in Little Haiti every third Friday for a night of Haitian music, art, food, and family fun. The November 16th edition features the roots group Boukman Experience in a free concert. Details at bignightlittlehaiti.com.
And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with television personality Joanne Weir. Her latest book is a companion to her PBS series. It's called Cooking Confidence, Dinner Made Simple, and she really gives you some great tips in this book on how to make things easy in the kitchen. But she's also been giving us tips for Thanksgiving, and we can have our Thanksgiving with confidence because she's given us such great, great tips, especially for the turkey. Well, it's dinner in minutes time, and so tonight, it's dinner in minutes, is autumn meatloaf with mashed sweet potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
So she already got... I wonder if I could put that vinegar in the mashed sweet potato. That might be good,
probably,
too. Yeah. Well, this meatloaf has a sweet and tangy glaze to it. And it's made with... That glaze is made with brown sugar and Dijon mustard. You just mix the two together. And I use ground veal because it makes a lighter texture. But if you prefer, you can also use ground chicken or turkey. And then my secret for cooking meatloaf that's really fast is I form it into small loaves. I put it on a baking sheet, and I make sure that my oven's at 400 degrees. And now, being on the baking sheet instead of in a pan means the air circulates around it, so it cooks faster. So you bake it for about 15 minutes. Take it out, put that glaze over
the top. So they're individual servings.
Right. It could be. Or you could make it, about 3 inches by 5 inches each. Mm-hmm. So that'd be individual ones. And then just take it out after 15 minutes and put more of that glaze on top, and then put it back in the oven for 5 minutes. So simple. And even easier is I make my mashed potatoes. I bake my potatoes in the microwave, and this is how I do it. I take the sweet potatoes, wash them, poke the skins with holes in the skin, wrap it in paper towels, and put it in the microwave for about 5 minutes. Then I take it out, scoop out the flesh, mix it with some olive oil, salt and vinegar, maybe some diced green pepper, and that's it. You can find that entire recipe and a photo at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. So what do you think of this that you've been eating, you two, Joe and Bonnie?
Excellent, excellent.
Yes?
Sounds delicious.
The Dijon mustard.
Thank you,
nice
Joanne. I have a friend here. It's a good thing my friend's on here. I haven't heard from Bonnie, but I'm not going to ask her anymore. That's going to be it. So,
give me tofu, Linda.
Oh, my goodness. Fine. All right, tofu meatloaf for Bonnie. You can put the glaze on it, though.
Okay, yes.
Yes, that would be good.
Yes, which
all
is
right.
Good.
Tasker, what are we drinking?
Well, as I said, Thanksgiving has always been my favorite holiday because you don't have to give presents, and you're not expected at any religious services, and you get to overindulge without being criticized and then sleep through a football game on TV. What more could you ask?
Your favorite day.
Favorite day. And the other nice thing is the Thanksgiving meal has so many different flavors to it that it, you can't possibly choose one wine that would go with all those flavors, so it gives you a chance to pull out all of your favorite wines. So here's my guide, course by course. With the appetizers, a Gloria Ferrer Blanc de Blanc sparkling wine, which is light and delicate and full of kind of crisp green apple flavors, and it's about $20. Now, for the main meal, you have to give each diner two glasses, one for white and one for red, to match all those food flavors. So for the white, I would suggest the Kendall Jackson White Summation. They call it Summation because I think it's the sum of every white grape they grow. It's a blend of Sauvignon Blanc, Viognier, Chardonnay, Semillon, Roussanne, Pinot Blanc, Riesling, and Muscat Canelli. So there's a flavor for every dish in there. And this is only about $11. And for the red, I would try a Ménage à Trois, which is a spicy, juicy blend.
Whoa. Where's he going?
This is NPR, Fred.
Yeah, well, this is three grapes getting together, so this is not what you're trying to imply. Anyway, it's Zinfandel, Merlot, and Cabernet, and it's $12. Then with the pumpkin pie, I would serve the Hoag Vineyards Late Harvest Riesling Dessert Wine from Washington State. It's crisp and sweet and full of flavors of oranges and lemons and limes, and it's only $11. So these are pretty reasonable wines. Now, another wine that would go well with turkey is French Beaujolais, and handily, today is Beaujolais Nouveau Day.
It's in all the stores today. I checked.
I'll bet it is, yeah. At 1 minute after midnight this morning, Beaujolais producers were permitted to release their young red wine from this year's vintage, and it's always the first wine to be released. And the producers race to see who can be the first to get it to their clients. They used to fly it to the U.S. and the SST to get it here as quickly as they could. Now, Beaujolais is soft and very fruity, so it's the perfect wine for that turkey sandwich that you crave an hour after the big Thanksgiving dinner is over.
After because the dishes have been done.
Yeah,
I always say there's nothing like a big meal to make you hungry.
He really can't wait for Thanksgiving.
No, I can't.
No.
He's on to it. Well, we've got a question here from Lori in Miami. Hi, Lori. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm calling because I'm wondering, once I douse this turkey with this butter-drenched cheesecloth, can I use a convection oven? Does it need to be covered? How long should I bake the turkey for?
Well, is that a question to me?
Yes, of course. Sure. Go ahead,
Jenna. It's so once you drape the turkey with this cheesecloth, what you're going to do is I usually put it in a 400-degree oven, and I roast it, depending upon the size, until you put an instant-read thermometer into the thickest part of the thigh, and it should be about 165 to 170 degrees, because it's going to continue to go up a little bit as it rests.
And it's called an instant what?
Instant read thermometer. They're fantastic. Okay. There are some digital ones out there that are great, and you just insert this into the thigh, the thickest part of the thigh. Or you can also use a knife and see that the juices run clear. But I really think the instant read is more accurate.
Right, but she needs to know that the instant read is instant. You don't leave it in the oven.
Right, exactly. No. You just, that's why it's instant. Exactly.
You pull the turkey out a little bit and stick it in. And you have to wait about 20 seconds or so for it to register.
To be exactly right, correct.
Okay. And can it be a convection oven, and does it need to be covered?
It can be a convection oven. That's fine. And no, you're not going to cover it. Think of this cheesecloth as your cover.
Okay.
Actually, the convection of it might give it a little bit more of a brownie, a nice glow to it.
And a little quicker, too, right?
Mm-hmm. And should I adjust the temperature of the oven if it's a convection oven?
Usually 25 degrees, but I think for a turkey you're going to be okay. I mean 400 degrees, maybe, 375 with a convection oven.
Yeah, but don't forget that when you put the turkey in the oven, it's going to take up a large part of the oven.
Right.
And so it's not going to be the exact number. That 375 or 400 degrees, whatever, is only at the middle shelf. But in a convection, the air goes all around it.
Right.
I think the convection would be a good idea.
Yeah,
For a 14-pound turkey, about how long does that take?
I think it's around 2 hours, a little over 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Okay.
Okay. Well, have a nice Thanksgiving, Lori.
Thank you so much.
Yes. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Thank you.
And one warning to everyone is if you have a refrigerator that's groaning, maybe you should turn it down a little bit to make sure that refrigerator is cold enough for all the foods. And don't leave your foods out for a long time and then get them out the next day. You might have some problems, so be careful.
We don't want any salmonella.
Exactly.
I think the other thing that people forget, too, is once they take the turkey out of the oven, to let it rest for those 30 minutes.
Okay.
Don't carve it right away, or you're going to have the juices all over the counter.
All over the counter, for sure.
As opposed to in your stomach.
Joanne, it's always wonderful talking with you. It's been a delicious, tasty week. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Happy holidays to all of you.
Great cooking tips. Her book is Cooking Confidence, Dinner Made Simple. Terrific book. If you're going to bring a gift to somebody, a hostess gift, if you've been invited out, that's a great gift to give someone.
And that was some meatloaf, Linda.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, great to be with you. I'm going to wish you all a very, very delicious and happy Thanksgiving. We'll be back in 2 weeks with Josh Schoenwald and The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food.
Thanks, Linda.
I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And thanks for listening this hour. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brenner-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. And follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page for author and book links and much more. We have free audio archives and downloads at our new and improved website. That's WLRN.org. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat, another of his patented in-studio live concerts. They're setting up as we speak. Monday, we discuss psychopaths. They aren't necessarily twisted and violent. And to the calendar, on this day in 1864, 148 years ago, Union General William Tecumseh Sherman begins his infamous march to the sea after burning many buildings in Atlanta. He took Savannah, Georgia, 3 days before Christmas. And here's one which will make boomers feel old. On this day in 1932, 80 years ago, the birth of singer Petula Clark in Epsom, Surrey, England. She was a child star during World War II, of course. Downtown, I Know a Place, Don't Sleep in the Subway. Petula Clark now lives in Switzerland. And one more while we recall the swashbucklers, the Mark of Zorro, and witness for the prosecution. On this day, 1958, 54 years ago, the death of actor Tyrone Power at age 44 in Spain. His wife gave birth to their only son 2 months later. And we leave with a quote from General Sherman. Quote, "If I had my choice, I would kill every reporter in the world. But I'm sure we'd be getting reports from hell before breakfast." This is Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman and Linda Gassenheimer. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.